capably done. Tonight we're ready to study John chapter 11. And before we do, Michael will lead us in a prayer. Thank you. Okay, we're studying John chapter 11 tonight. And this, of course, is the resurrection of Lazarus. And I have to tell you, I totally changed my plan on how to do this. There are many interesting things in this chapter, many. And we don't have time to cover all of them. But at first I was thinking, well, everybody knows about the resurrection of Lazarus. They know that story, so I'll just kind of gloss over that, and then we'll discuss some of the other interesting things. And then the more I got to thinking about it, the more I realized how foolish I was in that way of thinking, because the resurrection of Lazarus is very important. It's very important to people in that day, and it's even important today. So bear with me a little bit as I try to discuss with you for the first few minutes the importance of the resurrection of Lazarus to three groups, and it'll come from Scripture. The first group is the disciples of Jesus. And let's look at in chapter 11, read verses 11 through 15. And we have Jesus talking here, and this he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep." The disciples then said to him, "Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he was speaking of literal sleep. So Jesus then said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him." Two comments about that. One of them is, if you think about it, Jesus using slumber as a way to describe death ought to be a really comforting thing for Christians. Because our understanding is that somebody who falls asleep wakes up. And Jesus is talking about Lazarus being asleep. And of course, he really was talking about death. But we all hope that when we fall asleep, we'll wake up. So it's a kind of a comforting way that Jesus talked about death. But what I really want to get at is why this was important to the disciples. It's in verse 15. "I'm glad for your sakes," says Jesus, "that I was not there, so that you may believe. Now let's go to him." And this was a faith builder for them. It would give them confidence. Now think about when they would draw back on this memory after he was crucified and raised and ascended back into heaven and he was gone. And they were given the task of spreading the gospel. It was a dangerous task. And history tells us that all of them but one were probably killed because of their faith in Jesus Christ and their preaching of the gospel. But imagine as they're preaching to a hostile audience and they're thinking, "Wow, this could be the last sermon I ever preach," given the look in these people's eyes. They could go back and realize what Jesus said. "I will raise you up." And that would give them comfort, I believe, and the courage to keep on preaching because they knew he could do it. They watched him do it with Lazarus. Well, another group, Jesus' enemies and those who were unbelievers. Recall what we discussed back in chapter 5. And let's go back and read three verses. Chapter 5, verses 19 through 21. I made the comment at the time that I think that Jesus had in mind that he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead way before he raised him from the dead. Obviously, he could have chosen to know that had he wanted to, and I think he did. And I think that's what he had in mind in John chapter 5, beginning with verse 19. "Therefore, Jesus answered and was saying to them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, these things the Son also does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself is doing, and the Father will show him greater works than these, so that you will marvel.'" And then listen to what he says in verse 21, "For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son also gives life to whom he wishes." Now at the end of verse 20, he says, "The Father will show greater works than these, so that you will marvel." And then he asserts that just as the Father has the ability to raise the dead and give life, so does he. Now, that was for the unbelievers and the enemies. And he had told them repeatedly that he was the Son of God, that he and the Father had the same purpose. And now he is giving them a sign that is irrefutable evidence to the honest heart. Irrefutable. I mean, the guy's been dead 4 days, buried, smells as a body deteriorates, and Jesus raises him back. To the honest heart, that is irrefutable evidence. Now, we know he wasn't dealing with honest hearts, but that was a very meaningful sign to them. The third group to whom the resurrection of Lazarus is important is us. Let's go to a verse that we've looked at several times in the 20th chapter of John. John tells us what the purpose of this book is. And I think one of the reasons that the resurrection of Lazarus was put in there was for you and me. In John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, he says, "Therefore many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So, who's he writing that to? He's writing it to the people who are going to read his letter, his epistle. And that includes us. So, 2,000 years later, he's saying that we might believe when we read this, and in believing that we can have life in his name. Now, I'm going to tell you, resurrecting the dead is a challenging concept for me. Have you ever thought about somebody being raised back from the dead? I mean, we read about it in the Bible, yes. But how often does that happen in your daily life? It doesn't happen at all to mine. From our earthly point of view, death is permanent. It's a permanent separation of somebody we care about, or maybe just an acquaintance, but usually somebody we care about, it has an impact on us. And when they die, it's a permanent separation from an earthly point of view. And yet the resurrection of Lazarus from the dead, if we believe that Jesus really did that, that is our evidence that Jesus can raise us from the dead in the last day. It's a very meaningful thing. Now Jesus, look in chapter 11. Jesus is asking us a question through John's inspired writing. He asks us a question, and it's a sobering question. So let's look at it. In John chapter 11, tonight's chapter, verses 25 and 26, here's what Jesus says to Martha. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" That was a question for Martha. That's a question for us. Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? That's a question for me, and it's a question for you. And it's everything. It means everything. And the fact that we have evidence here that Jesus raised a man from the dead who'd been dead for 4 days is evidence for us that he can raise us too. Anybody have any comments? What's that?
I said just that I love the response that he gets.
Oh, the response that he gets is fantastic. I would hope that we can all say what Martha said in verse 27. She said to him, "Yes, Lord." And listen to the things that she acknowledges in this. First of all, "Yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into this world." That's the answer he was looking for. And he's still looking for that answer. God, I hope all of us can give that one. Anybody else have a comment about that? I think I was wrong in glossing over the importance of the resurrection of Lazarus. I think it's very important. Sure did. He said, I thought you said, the reason why I hesitate, I thought you said he lied. And I thought, wait a minute. Go ahead. Yes. Yeah, well, to support what you said, all through his interaction with the Jewish leaders, he was speaking spiritually and they were speaking physically. Many of them never caught on to what he was talking about. But he's always putting everything in the greater perspective at the end. And at the end, if we live faithfully, the resurrection solves all of our problems. Anybody else? As if they discussed it before they talked to Jesus. That's true, Jimmy, but there was a limit. Had you been here, he would not have died. Well, now, wait a minute. If he really is who he says he is, he could still take care of the situation. And Martha gives us a little hint about that. Look at what she says. She says in 21 what you said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." But in 22, she says, "Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Now, I think Martha has this little glimmer of maybe he could still do this. But Martha's thinking like the rest of us think in daily life, and that is when somebody dies, it's permanent and they're dead. And that's it. And yet she still says, well, maybe. Now Mary didn't say, well, maybe. Mary said, man, if you'd have been here, you could have saved him. Yeah, it's very interesting. By the way, just as a little side note, the Jews back then had a superstition that when somebody died, the spirit of the dead person hovered around the body for 3 days. And after 3 days, and I don't know where this came from, maybe it's because, you know, sometimes we have people who we think died, and somehow they come back to life. We say, man, they came back from the dead. We can't explain it. Well, maybe that happened a few times back in that day. But they had this idea that the spirit hovered around the body for 3 days, and after 3 days, the spirit gave up and said, okay, that's it, and took off. So it's really interesting that Lazarus, before Jesus came back, Lazarus had been dead 4 days. So he even destroyed this silly superstition they had. You know, is he really dead? Well, after 2 days, he's not really dead because the spirit's hovering. But after 4 days, he's dead. So I don't know if Jesus purposely waited 4 days or not. But well, one other little thing to think about here before we get into the text. Have you ever put yourself, maybe this is a crazy way of thinking, but every now and then I think like this. Have you ever put yourself, try to put yourself in their situation back in the first century when Jesus now comes to town and here is this guy who's claiming to be the Son of God, and would you have believed? I mean, obviously, Jesus didn't convince everybody. He convinced some people. They believed him, but there are a whole lot of people who did not believe him. And think about this. Let's go back to just regular daily life. back during that time. These are people that had family responsibilities. They worked to support their family. Some of them were parents. Some were husbands. Some were wives. They had to deal with social responsibilities of daily life, you know, getting up, going to work every day. They had to deal with governmental things. They had to deal with conflicts that might go on in society. They had to deal with the consequences of sin. And then what happens is they encounter somebody named Jesus. And Jesus says, I am from heaven, and I'm the Son of God, and you need to believe in me. And I'm going to present some teachings to you, and you need to accept those. And if you do, you'll be raised again and live eternally. Now put yourself in their shoes. Would you have believed him? Well, a lot of people didn't. But what was required was faith that he was who he said he was, and obedience, as Paul talks about it in Romans 1:5, the obedience of faith. Okay, now let's bring it to our situation. We all have daily living situations to deal with. Many of you all are husbands, wives, parents. You've got those responsibilities. We still have to work to make a living to support families. We still have social considerations. We still have governmental situations. There's still conflict in daily life. There's illness to deal with. And there's still the consequences of sin. And yet, in the 21st century, all of us who are in this building have encountered this man named Jesus. Now, our encounter with him is different. We encounter him through the pages of the New Testament, or we encounter him maybe for the first time by hearing a gospel sermon somewhere where somebody presents some things about the Bible we've never considered before. Now, whose challenge to believe Jesus was the most difficult? Theirs, with this guy who they say, hey, we know where this guy's from. He can't be from heaven. We know his parents. Any good thing ever going to come out of Nazareth? This guy's a nobody, a carpenter. He didn't even study with the scholars. And yet what's required for them was faith and obedience to have eternal life. And what's required of us is, looking at the evidence, faith and obedience in the same Jesus. Now, who had it harder? They or us? I don't know. Yes. Let's go to it. It's chapter 20, verse 28. Thomas had wanted to see the scars. And it says, Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. And verse 29 is the one Jimmy's mentioning. Jesus said to him, because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I don't know if any of you ever try to go back and think, what would you have done back then? You know, would you have been in the crowd that yelled, crucify him, crucify him? Or would you have been one who's scared to death sitting over there hoping they don't detect you? Or where would we have been? Of course, we like to think of ourselves in the best possible light. Anybody else have a comment about that? Okay. Well, let's look at the verses that talk about the actual raising of Lazarus. 34. Chapter 11, we'll start in verse 34. Interesting. Jesus says in verse 34, where have you laid him? Now, don't you know Jesus knew where they laid him? He knew where Lazarus was. So why would he ask this question? I think it's for the same reason that with a woman taken in adultery, he makes his comments and then pauses. And what he's doing is he was a master of seizing the drama of the moment to increase the interest of everybody who needed to be paying attention. where have you laid him? And then they, okay. And now, you know, all these people have already followed Mary out of the house. They saw her get up and leave. And there were a bunch of Pharisees who were there. So apparently Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were wealthy people because they had a bunch of Pharisees there. And they were in Bethany, which was only 2 miles from Jerusalem. So there were a bunch of the upper crust at their house. And when Mary gets up and goes out to meet Jesus, they get up and follow her out. Well, what does that guarantee? That they're going to watch this resurrection of Lazarus. That's what it guarantees. Okay. He said, where have you laid him? And they said, Lord, come and see. And then the verse that says this, that little kids have memorized since they were five, because it's only two words. What's the shortest verse in the Bible? Oh, John 11:35. Jesus wept. So the Jews were saying, see how he loved him? But some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man also from dying? Now, what's wrong with that question? Keep in mind, we're talking about Jewish leaders here. When John uses the word the Jews, he's almost always talking about the Pharisees and those people. So what's wrong with what they say in verse 37? Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Exactly. But not only is it accusatory, what are they now admitting that they would refuse to admit when it happened? That he healed the guy. And the only reason they're ready to admit it now is because they're now using it as a way to criticize him. Don't you know people like that? They never acknowledge anybody for anything unless they can use it to zap somebody. And we saw that during the presidential campaign for the whole last year, where everybody take everything everybody said and just nitpick it to death, and they give somebody credit for this so they could slam them for that. And that's what these guys were doing. It's really a sleazy comment. 38. So Jesus, again being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, remove the stone. Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he's been dead 4 days. Now Jesus gives her one of the mildest little rebukes. He's very gentle with Martha. But remember what he said to her back in verses 25 and 26. He said, I'm the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Martha, do you believe this? Okay. Now we go back, or it was to Martha, wasn't it? Yes. Now we go to verse 40. Jesus said to her, did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? Come on, Martha. Remember what we've talked about now. Come on. So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. But because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me. His prayer to the Father was for the benefit of the witnesses. 43, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And the man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Therefore, many of the Jews, and this reaction is unbelievable to me, but therefore many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. Good for them. 46, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Now, why did they go tell the Pharisees? Well, there really are two possibilities. We don't know which is the case. I know which one I lean toward, only because I know what they were like. But one of them is, they were so amazed that Jesus raised this guy from the dead that they went and told the Pharisees, guess what? This guy who claims to be the Son of God just raised somebody from the dead. Isn't that wonderful? The other possibility is they went and said, you guys got a problem. Because this guy who claims to be the Son of God and says he can give life to people and raise the dead, he has done it. What are you going to do about that? And we see that all they did was sharpen up their knives and get ready to go after him some more. Anybody have a guess as to why they went and told the Pharisees?
Thank you.
And we know and how silly they are, Jimmy. We know what they tried to do in chapter 12. They wanted to kill Lazarus again, so the guy wasn't alive. How low can you get? Well, look at what Jesus said in 43. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Now, go back to what we read in chapter 5, verse 28. Jesus is talking about the resurrection. Remember this when we discussed this? John 5, 28. "Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and will come forth." So what Jesus said to Lazarus is what Jesus is going to say to you and me. Scott Perkins, come forth, and you're going to come. And I hope he says, Bob Simpson, come forth. Won't that be wonderful? Same thing he said to Lazarus. Only Lazarus is going to get to hear it twice. Well, let's talk about Jesus' emotions. Laura, you brought up emotional reactions to death. And I think it's kind of touching if we look at Jesus' emotions here. And let's just look at some verses. First of all, chapter 11, verse 5. And I'm just going to recount the verses here where it shows Jesus' emotion. Chapter 11, verse 5 says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus." He loved them. I don't know what his association was with them and what their history was, but whatever it was enough that he loved them. Now let's go to 35. 35 says Jesus wept. Well, he wasn't weeping out of joy, obviously weeping out of sorrow. Then we go to 38, and it says, "So Jesus, again being deeply moved within," which obviously is talking about emotion, "came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it." Now we see the same kind of wording in 33, but there's something interesting about that that you might not have ever thought about before. But let's read verse 33. "When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled." Now, deeply moved in spirit, I understand. But this word troubled is an interesting word. Another translation of the Greek word, and the Greek word is something called, I don't know how you say this, but tarasso in English, T-A-R-A-S-S-O, tarasso. And it means troubled in the sense of agitating. It has kind of a negative connotation to it. Now, I've always taken it to mean that he was deeply moved and was troubled because they were so sad. But it's possible that he was deeply moved and sad, but he was also agitated. And if you look at the literal translation, it says Jesus troubled himself, or Jesus was agitated over what he saw there. Now, can you think of any reason why Jesus might have had a negative feeling about that? I think that's possible. I've come up with five possibilities, and I don't know that any of them are true. But one of them was he was truly agitated over the fact that Mary and Martha were grieving so, and that agitated him. Second possibility, as Jimmy mentioned, the hypocrisy of the Jews. He knew what they were really like. They were not honest of heart, and they had terrible motives. And their sympathy with Mary and Martha, there's a good chance that many of them were faking it and they didn't really care. Maybe there was a meal involved. It's also possible that he was agitated because thinking about the death of Lazarus caused things to come to his mind about his own death to come. And we know that troubled him in other passages, especially in the garden. It could also be that he was troubled over the result of sin that caused, as you mentioned very early, caused sadness and death. The plight of mankind. And you say, well, that's a pretty heavy thing to think about, but we're talking about Jesus. He thought about heavy things. And then he might have been also thinking about the fact, have you ever thought about this? That Lazarus had died and apparently was in paradise and was now coming back and was going to be re-exposed to all the temptations of daily life. Double jeopardy for Lazarus. You ever thought about that? Jesus must have been pretty confident that Lazarus was going to make all the right choices again. So I don't know. I don't know that he was agitated about that or agitated in a positive way because of seeing the grief of everybody. But what impresses me is Jesus came to earth and assumed the form of a man, and he was susceptible to all the emotions that a man has. He was susceptible to grief and sadness. He was susceptible to anger. He was susceptible to hunger. He was susceptible to pain. He was susceptible to humiliation. And he gave up his place in heaven to come down and be susceptible to all the human things that you and I are susceptible to so that he could die, so that you and I could have eternal life. That's a touching thing to me that he was willing to do. I still can't believe he did it. I believe he did it. But just think what that took, what he left, what he came to, and what he experienced so that you and I could have eternal life. Pretty amazing thing. Any comments about that? Which one do you opt for?
I was thinking towards the hypocrisy of the Jews, but you took back to John chapter 5:29. He said, and will come forward those who did the good deeds to resurrection of life. Can't help but think that had to really move them to think, here is Lazarus who is benefiting from that life well lived. And he said, he sent where he needs to be, where Paul longed to go.
But I think we can be confident that Lazarus made the choices correctly again. Okay, we don't have much time. Let's look at a really interesting little thing. We talk about, for 2,000 years, we've talked about doubting Thomas. Okay? So, let's look at verse 14. Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. 16, therefore Thomas, who is called Didymus, which means twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go so that we may die with him. Let us also go so that we may die with him. So what is he presuming? That Jesus' trip back to Judea is going to be successful? So is this a positive comment to Thomas's account or a negative comment? Well, I think it's both. One of them, he says, let us go back with him so that we may die with him. That's a pretty courageous thing, and it shows great loyalty. But on the other hand, the doubting part that is in Thomas's heart shines forth again. Jesus said, we're going back there. And I'm glad the guy's dead because I'm going to raise him, and you all are going to get to see that, and it's going to be good for you. And Thomas says, well, okay, if he's intent to go back, let's all go back with him. We'll all die together. That's a lack of faith on Thomas's part. Any comments about that?
So when you cover this verse, any chance at all that Thomas doesn't get out of here? Any chance Thomas is like, well, we'll give you more than one person to raise, offer ourselves up as well. We'll die and you raise us as well. Think of the opportunity that offers in itself.
You're quite the optimist.
Yeah.
Okay.
Told that
Thomas is a guy who saw a cloud within every silver lining. Well, we've had one buzzer. Let's look at one other really interesting thing, what God did to Caiaphas. I've always called him Caiaphas. I've heard other people say Caiaphas. I don't know what his name is, but anyway. 47. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So what they're presuming is that if a bunch of people started following Jesus, that they would resist Roman rule, and the Romans would get irritated and come in and just take them over. So here's what Caiaphas says. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, by the way, that doesn't mean the high priest changed every year. Caiaphas had been high priest 15 years, and he was high priest three more years after this. But what John is doing is identifying what year that was. He was the high priest that year that Jesus was going through all this. Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, Mr. Tact. Nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish." So what is he saying? He's not prophesying about Jesus, at least he didn't intend to. What he's saying is, let's go ahead and kill this guy so that all these people don't follow him and irritate the Romans and they come in and wipe us all out. He thought that killing Jesus would solve that problem and save Israel. Now, the really ironic thing about this is, about 40 years later, the Romans came in and wiped out Israel anyway with the destruction of Jerusalem. But here's what God did to Caiaphas. 51. Now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So what God did was maybe even put the words in Caiaphas' mouth that this man is going to die for the nation. And John is saying Caiaphas uttered words that he had no idea what he was saying. And you know, some of the Old Testament prophets did the same thing. They didn't know what they were talking about, but they were saying pretty heavy things, prophesying about the Messiah. And it turns out Caiaphas, who was the ultimate enemy of Jesus Christ, also prophesied about the Messiah, but he didn't know he was doing it. That's really ironic. That is a pleasing irony about Caiaphas. And if he knew what he was doing, he'd have rolled over in his grave. Appreciate your comments. Next week we'll do chapter 12.